right, welcome back to the Michael Slate Show. That's right, welcome back, just week after week. It's actually very exciting. I'm always coming in with, just really eager to get into it. And today we're going to get into a hell of a lot. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Zimbabwean playwright and award-winning playwright Danai Gurira. And we're talking about her play, The Convert, a really compelling, very powerful play. So we'll be talking with her about that. And before talking to Danai, we'll be talking with, if everything goes right, we're going to be talking with that curmudgeonly madman, P.Z. Myers, the biology professor at the University of Minnesota Morris and the author of the blog Feringula, the largest science blog in the world. We're going to be talking about the Tennessee monkey law and all the idiocy that goes along with that. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back Bianca Bagatorian. Bianca's a playwright, and actually what I've seen of Bianca's plays, and I have to tell you this, Bianca, right away, I've enjoyed what I've seen so much, I need to see more.
Oh, thank you, yeah, Michael. Sure. That's great.
And she's working on a new film called Warning Signs. It's a film about genocide in Rwanda, and actually even extending beyond Rwanda in terms of the bigger picture, and what we can learn from that. And Bianca's also the author of a play called March, A Powerful Eyewitness to the Armenian Genocide, which was up a couple years ago, but is still, just looking at what you, at the clips you have on your site, very, very powerful. And this is a story that really needs to be told today. You know, we really need to get into this. So, Bianca, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Michael. Glad to be here always.
I want the audience to get a little bit of a sense of what your film Warning Signs is about.
Sure.
And so I'm going to give them a taste of that, and then we'll come back and open up with the discussion of the film.
Great.
I lost my parents and four sisters. I was hiding with my colleague in primary school in his house. But they didn't find me in a home, but they came and killed everybody who was at my home.
My dad told me just run away. And I hid myself in the bushes. After a few minutes, we had a shotgun. That was my dad killed.
Mes soeurs. My grand sœur,
all my older sisters, I am the youngest in my family, all of them were killed by their husbands.
Just as you might prepare for an approaching hurricane, once the warning signs are there, we must also learn to see the warning signs of genocide and raise the alarm before it's too late.
All right, that was a part of a trailer for Bianca Bagatorian's new film, the film she's working on called Warning Signs, and it's about the genocide in Rwanda. And Bianca, you know, this is, as we were talking earlier in the day, this is sort of the month for remembering, for marking genocide.
Yes, it is. It's the Armenian Genocide Commemoration is April 24th. And actually, it's also Genocide Month in Rwanda. I believe the date is April 7th when they commemorate the 1994 genocide. So.
Now, as I said, you worked on the march, which drew from, 800 hours of oral
histories from the Armenian Library and Museum in Boston, right?
Right. And so you painted a very graphic, very compelling, very moving, intensely emotional story of this heinous, heinous crime against
humanity. Well, it is. Yeah. It's the largest crime on earth. Amazing that it still happens today.
Yeah. Yeah, and that there's still a lot of denial around it, and there's still a political football all the time between the imperialists and everybody else.
Definitely.
Yeah,
denial, which is one of the warning signs. I just wanted to say these warning signs, what was very interesting for me to learn when I was in Rwanda last summer was that these are common warning signs for all the genocides that have occurred in the past 100 years. So this film will actually be looking at Rwanda. It'll be looking at the Holocaust. It'll be looking at many different genocides that have all shared the same warning signs.
Well, let's talk about Rwanda in particular. What brought you to Rwanda?
Right. That's a good point. I think that brings some context to this conversation. My friend Eric Ann, who heads playwriting at Brown University, had been encouraging me to go with a group of artists that he takes there every year. He's been going there for 9 years, and he'll take students, playwrights, directors, people to just go and bear witness, just to be there, not for any particular purpose. And I had realized instinctively that it would have been it's a really good idea for me, having come from a background of genocide. I'd like to go somewhere where I could feel the consequences of a more recent genocide. I just kind of wanted to be there and physically, viscerally feel what it would be like. And I had no idea exactly how much, it was going to affect me. I mean, it just shook me to the core just being there. It wasn't just about like hearing the stories, but just bearing witness to the suffering, to the youth that 98% of the children in Rwanda have now grown up having experienced and seen the genocide. So it was very moving on a deep level. So that's how I ended up just going there. And then I stumbled across this idea of warning signs, everyone I was talking to, and I realized there's a research professor in genocide studies called Gregory Stanton, and he had actually coined this phrase, warning signs, and I thought that was fascinating. But it kind of depicts how, like a storm building, we can see this coming. Genocide doesn't just, happen overnight. You need an army, you need the state behind you. It is a very planned destruction of an ethnic or racial group. So what shocked me was, you mean thousands of people are being killed? We can see this coming. Why isn't anything being done about this? And so, I really wanted to point that out. I realize that most people like me don't realize that we can see this is coming. So, in fact, in July, we're going back to Rwanda with Gregory Stanton. My filmmaker, Jeff Kalustin, is coming with me as well, and some other, Peter Balakian, some other scholars, to talk about this. And we want to continue doing this film because we think it's very important to point this out.
Well, let me say one thing about the sort of the uniqueness of your film too. From what I've seen and from when we've talked, you approach it. It's very. I think there's a very big pull whenever you're doing a film about something like a genocidal attack, a genocidal assault, a massive crime against humanity, to always tell it mainly from the victim side. But you actually took a different tact in this, because you went in and explored what the hell was going on in the heads of the people who were the perpetrators of the genocide. How did you come to that point where you wanted to tell that story?
Well, I just can't understand how, one of the things I think it's important for everyone to go to a place like Rwanda. It doesn't matter if you genocide has happened in your background or not, but it's just to go and see how we as human beings, what we can do to each other. And that just always, I wanted to learn, emotionally, how does one human being kill 77 people? Like I was mentioning, I was listening to the BBC today, and the guy, Anders Breivik, who killed 77 people in Norway, he just said today, I had to stifle my emotions. I had to dehumanize these people so that I could kill them. And dehumanization is one of the warning signs. In Rwanda, often during genocides, they will, they have this campaign where they turn the ethnic group into animal names. They call them animal names. In Rwanda, the Tutsis were called cockroaches, or Inezi in Rwandan. In the Armenian genocide, the Turks called the Armenians dogs. And so once you start, looking at people like dogs or cockroaches, and the radio in Rwanda kept saying, step on those cockroaches, they're dirty, kill them, it becomes easy. And I think that to me is fascinating, getting into the mind of these perpetrators, how they can do that and how we can stop this from happening.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Bianca Bagatorian, playwright, writer, and filmmaker, and we're talking about her work around genocide, and in particular the film she's working on called Warning Signs, a film about the genocide in Rwanda. Now, Bianca, one of the things, let's dig into some of these warning signs, because it's very striking when
yes.
you say these things are actually – there's a process. This is different than just sort of a mass upheaval. This is different than people just suddenly snap one day.
Yeah.
There's actually a whole process that goes
Doesn't
on.
Doesn't happen overnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk about some of the warning signs.
Well, another one, a really obvious one, is when they start dividing people into groups based on their ethnicity. In Rwanda, they started handing out identity cards, and they were dividing the people that, you're a Hutu and you're a Tutsi. So that's always a scary sign. And, I guess in Cambodia, it's when they were handing out these blue and white checkered scarves and making people wear that. So when you start to divide people, the yellow star in the Holocaust, when you start giving out little identity symbols to people and saying you're this and you're that, I mean, that's another one of the warning signs. I mean, we were talking earlier in this country, I mean, this just with what happened with the Trayvon Martin case, hoodies in this country. And suddenly people wearing hoodies or kids, they're kids. We don't look at them as kids anymore. They're suddenly we look at them as people who are going to cause trouble or perpetrators. So this is a danger. And that exists in our country today. But it's when a lot of these warning signs start to add up. So, you know, there's 8 or 9 of them. You know, you have to be really careful so that they don't add up, because then, you know, when they add up is when the danger starts to happen.
Well, this is, you know, and it's interesting because these signs actually go on. They don't. It's not like 1, 2, 3, 4. It's not a linear thing. It seems they're all going on at the same time. And as they develop to a more complex and greater danger. But they're all going on at any given time. Is that right?
Yes. And there's another scholar. She was actually hired by the U.S. Government to do the study in 1998. And she came up with one of these terms called exclusionary ideology. And I think in this country that exists towards race. I think that we have a fear of race. And so that fear creates this exclusionary ideology. And that's going on at the same time, you know, as well. And so you have that going on. You have the hoodie thing going on. Dehumanization is always going on. So, yeah, they all – it's not linear at all. It's just wherever, you know, hate speech, that's a big one. And that's why you have to be really careful, starting at schools, with children, any kind of hate speech. Like, so all of these are – you have to, like, maintain these at all times. They're simultaneously happening.
You know, it's very interesting to me because it just enraging because, you know, you think about this. And I know a lot of people will look at you if you talk about genocide in relation to black people in this country. A lot of people will say, oh, come on. It's bad, but it's not that bad. And when I'm looking at the warning signs that you've been concentrating on, you've been talking about, and other things that come up, and other people have written about this as well, and this whole point about all the things that you're talking about, including, you know, look, the segregation of people into, you know, ghettos and prisons and, you know, and the fact that when they come out of prison, they're, you know, whatever, they're still segregated very much in what Michelle Alexander calls a new Jim Crow. You know, there's a whole scene there. And I remember when I was a kid, when you talk about the dehumanization, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had very, very strictly segregated neighborhoods, you know, and I'll never forget this. One of the things that really just drove me over a wall when I was in like second grade, I never understood that because my mother grew up in a black neighborhood and she was all very, you know, we as a family, as a group, we had a lot of contact with black people, but we had to go out of the neighborhood to do that. And, but when I was in school, and this was a Catholic school, okay, and they used to sell those little black licorice babies, you know, with sugar on them. And the nun would stand up and she'd walk around the aisle selling N babies to kids, you know, and you
it's
were
amazing.
Thinking, yeah. And you're thinking that the way people were dehumanized, you know, there was this, always this sort of thing in the background that black people were different. Black people were different. Black people aren't people, you know, and then you see how this actually rolls on. And we're now in a position where you have such a huge percentage of black people, you know, under arrest in jail or under the authority of the state in one way or another. You know, the direct authority, the justice system in one way or another, and how that actually plays out and how, you know, I keep thinking about this genocide. And, you know, as we were talking earlier, that, you know, genocide is something that Eugene Jarecki, the filmmaker, called it a slow Holocaust going on in relation to black people in this country. And you know, we've referred to it in Revolution Newspaper as a slow genocide, but we've also made the point that it can very quickly make a leap. You know, and even without you realizing that it's going to go there, it can very quickly make a big leap into a fast genocide.
It's true. I think, the term genocide actually means the planned extermination of a nation or a national or racial group. So I think we need to be really, really careful about that. It's interesting. In my research, we've been looking at a lot of rap artists, and in their lyrics, they will use the word genocide. It comes up a lot, like genocide's happening in our streets. And, you know, I can see what they're saying, but we also like have to be really careful of using that term, because it can then become dismissive of huge genocides where, you know, 1.5 million people, you know, get eliminated. Raphael Lemkin, who coined the phrase genocide in 1943, I mean, the roots of the word genos means tribe or race, and side is Latin for killing. So it's kind of like killing of a racial group. So I know there's a lot of fear of mixing up what's going on in this country, you know, happening in the streets or happening to black people with a genocide. event that takes place in an entire nation. But I can see what you're saying. There is sort of a slow genocide going on, and that is something to be careful about in this country.
Yeah, you know, and particularly when you look at like the trajectory of things, you know, which is, you know, look, it's bad enough. Whatever signs are there, it's bad enough that they're there, you know.
And that brings us to another one of the signs, which is denial. I mean, that we have to be very careful of denial, because that is like one of the – what Gregory Stanton calls one of the last stages of genocide, like after it's done. And to me, the denial is almost like a genocide in itself, because you're killing the memory of what happened too.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Bianca Bagatorian, playwright, writer, and filmmaker. And we're talking about her work around genocide, and in particular, the film she's working on called Warning Signs, a film about the genocide in Rwanda. Now, Bianca, let's dig into this question of denial a little bit more, because I know this is a point that's made, in fact, by one of the people who's in your film. The point is made that there's tremendous consequences. After the killing stops, there's these tremendous consequences. What are those consequences?
Well, if you deny something's happened, of course, that makes the perpetrators feel we can do this again. So that is the main problem with denial. But, you know, there's also the respect for your ancestors that were killed and, you know, the whole thing by being denied, by erasing it. That to me is a bigger crime. You're doing the genocide again today, daily. And of course, in this country, you know, we're very concerned with the denial of the Armenian genocide, of course. And to us, that's a really, really big issue.
You know, there's something else I wanted to talk about in relation to some of these warning signs. And that is that there's a point, again, in the trailer to your film, a man makes the statement that genocide is the end point of exclusion. And I kept thinking about that in relation to black people in this country too. As you know, and you can see it historically in other genocides, but it really, I mean, you can see it right here in a sense of yet another factor. Let's talk a little bit about that, the end point of exclusion. Very heavy statement to make there.
Yeah. I remember the guy that made it, his whole family was killed in the genocide. It is. It's just kind of like saying you don't exist in a way. You know, your family doesn't exist. What happened doesn't exist. It's something that we, you know, can fight against today. Once the genocide is over, that's something we can fight to try and bring back, is to erase that denial. I mean, another one of the warning signs is places where prior genocides have occurred are very rife that it can happen again. So places like Rwanda, places like Turkey, you know, you always have to like be careful. And of course, the denial feeds into that. You know, there's a place where, you know, this could immediately happen, and then there's the denial of it. I mean, in this country, and when we think of the American Indians too, I mean, we need to face the fact that this country was also, you know, built on genocide too. And that denial in itself is huge.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we have to consider, I think, in any discussion of genocide, and you are very focused on not only just revealing what genocide is, what's happened, but also the idea that we need to stand up against this. You make a statement that it's in the 21st century, it's unacceptable to say we didn't see it coming. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but there's also part of that I think you have to – there's something I think people need to wrestle with, which is the role of the state in all this, because, you know, it's one thing to say that we as individuals or even as groups can stand up and look at these warning signs and saying, no, we're not going to do it. But we also have to realize we're going up against the state, because without a state, it seems in some form, in some way involved in this, it seems a genocidal assault would be very, very difficult to carry out.
I think that's one of the problems when we look at such a mass killing. How can I, as one individual, affect something that's going on where hundreds of thousands of people are being killed? What was interesting was, as a result of all these warning signs, I came to learn through my research that what it boils down to, and this is by talking to many, many scholars, is that it comes down to political will. That if the political will to stop a genocide existed, then that could be stopped. But oftentimes, you know, like when Rwanda happened, you know, America just kind of pulled back. And there was nothing for America to gain from stopping that. That wasn't a priority on our agenda. So if there is political will, I think that that's the way things can stop. And I think as individuals, if we want to turn into activists, what we can do when we see these warning signs is get in touch with your local politicians, get on the phone, write the letters, sign the petitions. But if we do that, that's like one way of stopping this from happening.
Bianca Bagatorian, playwright, writer, filmmaker. Let's go on to that question a little bit more. You know, it's interesting, too, though, because I think we also have to look at, you know, yes, there's political will, but there's and it is true that, you know, nothing gets done in this world that's dominated by imperialism unless there is actually a preliminary transformation of things into capital. Are you going to make profit off it? Is it going to serve you one way or another? You know, and this is one of the things that I think it's really important around this is because when you look at this, when you look at genocide and you look at the whole way that this gets carried out, you know, look, even in Rwanda and Burundi, you know, both places had a lot of conflict between the Tutsis and the Hutus. And in nobody ever really looks at the role of British imperialism, for instance, in fomenting those conflicts, you know? I mean, there was a whole history of how colonialism developed. It relied on, in some places, on the Tutsis because they were more European-looking. They were, you know, and—
Well, that started, I think, in the 1940s by the Belgians. And,
oh, okay.
And these anthropologists that went in and they started to measure their noses and say, you know, you're taller, you look more European. You may have come from Ethiopia to the Tutsis, whereas the Hutus were shorter, stockier. They were more like farm workers. And, you know, they were just classified as being less intellectual. So that began the division between them.
Which had a role to play in the enforcement of colonialism.
Of course, you know, because if you split up a people, then, you know, you have more power over them. And so, you know, that started in the 1940s. And this whole thing in Rwanda has been going on where 30,000 people have been killed. I think it was 1989. I mean, this didn't just, like I said, happen overnight. But yes, it was the Belgians. And then there was the French involvement as well later, too. And it was constantly to their benefit to keep these people divided in smaller groups and fighting, you know, that infighting, of course, brought in, you know, they could take over and have power over the country. And another interesting thing, I mean, you speak about material gain that I learned, and this was just something I learned and I heard in Rwanda, and I'm not sure exactly how true it is, but the Congo, the Rwanda is one of the gateways to the Congo, where a lot of the minerals for, say, things like cell phones come from. You know, you hear these stories about the 12-year-olds that are like mining for these minerals. And one of the explanations for the 1994 genocide that I heard, and I, you know, this is all hearsay, I don't know how true this is, was that this chaos was created in Rwanda to just open that gateway into the Congo so that, you know, these big businesses could get in there easier and mine those minerals more. So it's just disgusting to think of, you know, how many people can die in this way and for what.
Well, Darfur, I mean, look at what's happening, you know, what has happened in Darfur. And then the thing, without understanding that, a lot of people, a lot of very good-hearted people, you know, the role of the U.S. and all these other imperial powers in relation to oil in Darfur, you know, and without understanding what's the driving force behind that and what will allow this to go on, people end up calling for U.S. military intervention, the U.S. to intervene more, which is actually
exactly. And, you know, it's interesting. As an artist, I've been holding these dialogues for the past few years about how do you stage political atrocity as a playwright, like on stage, and genocide to be able to bring this to audiences and to people so that people don't go, this isn't my genocide. This is happening millions of miles away in Africa, and it has nothing to do with me. And I think in our film, one of the things we're trying to show is the interconnectedness, how every one of us, you know, you pick up an iPhone or an iPad or something, you know, a lot of your minerals are coming from there. They're, you know, they're being built in China by, you know, iPhones are being built in China by 12-year-olds. In fact, there's that whole recent controversy going on about Foxconn in New York. A playwright, a friend of mine, Mike Daisy, did that play about, you know, and this whole controversy that he went there and he talked to these 12-year-olds that are making your iPhone. So this connects us to what's going on millions and millions of miles away. There's no more excuse of saying that, you know, I have nothing to do with that genocide. We all do. We all benefit. This global village, you know, we all benefit from what's going on in one way or another. And so we all need to also be responsible for what's
exactly.
going
on. Exactly. And that's the point we're going to end on, the responsibility that every one of us has. When you know something and you know it's wrong, you got to stand up and act against it.
You got to do something.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Just become aware. And I hope that this film will help to just make people a bit more aware that, you know, we can see this coming and to just get up and do something.
And we will have you back to talk about the film when you get it done. All right.
Fantastic.
So hurry up.
Thank you very much, Michael.
All right, Bianca. Great to talk with you again.
Same.
And we'll have you back again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Bianca Bhagatourian. Bianca is a playwright, a writer, a filmmaker, and we've been talking about her film that she's working on now called Warning Signs. It's about the genocide in Rwanda and genocide as an assault on humanity and a need for everyone in humanity to stand up against this. We're going to take a very quick musical break. I want you to listen to this, and then we're going to come back and be joined by PZ Myers to talk about the Tennessee Monkey Law.
So right now, by the miracle of recording Robin and Crystal Bernard singing a song that probably you haven't heard before, but I'm sure after you hear it this time, you'll want to be hearing it again. I don't know of any better way than just to call it what it is. It's the monkey song, and it's about the monkey theory, the ridiculous theory of evolution that refutes the Bible account of creation. Robin and Crystal Bernard.
I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. It seems so unbelievable, and yet they're saying it's true. They're teaching us about it in school now, that humans were monkeys once too. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. Although it's so ridiculous, they're teaching us now that it's true. The teachers that came from a monkey would be better off in a zoo. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. It seems so much more believable, and surely, surely it's true. The God made man in his image, no monkey story will do. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. This monkey business has to go, because it just isn't true. It's such a disgrace to the monkey, a disgrace to the human race too. Whoa, I'm no kin to the monkey, no, no, no. The monkey's no kin to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know much about his ancestors, but mine didn't swing from a tree. Mine didn't swing from a tree. Mine didn't swing from a tree.
Hey. All right, welcome back. That was those silky tones at the beginning of the song where Jerry Falwell introducing his little singing act, these two young kids that have gone on to be in the forefront of carving together what they hope to be a nation of idiots, okay? A nation of idiots that doesn't believe in science. And actually in Tennessee, they're in addition to the monkey law that they've passed, they're also working on passing a law that would bar teachers from teaching, get ready for this, gateway sex, okay? So we're going to have an entire just army of idiots who believe that holding hands and kissing will condemn them to the fires of hell. Yeah, okay. And joining us now to talk about all this is P.Z. Myers. P.Z. is a professor of biology at the University of Minnesota Morris, and he's the author of Pharyngula, the largest, most popular science blog in the world. P.Z. Myers, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi. Did you hear that song, brother?
What's that?
Did you hear that song?
Yes, it was lovely. This could work. We're raising a nation of idiots, but they're not going to breed with each other.
Listen, we're having a little trouble hearing you, so we're going to have to, you're going to have to talk a little loud and,
Yeah. I'm calling from Big Funk Lake.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about real quick. Let's talk about this law in Tennessee. The law, as I understand it, says that teachers now are allowed to question scientific controversies in science classes. And those scientific controversies are controversies around evolution, global warming, genetics, the chemical origin of humanity. And I can't remember what the other one was, but it was all, you know, these
human
are
cloning. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? What's going on with this law in Tennessee?
What's going on with the law is that they are trying to take advantage of people's sense of fairness, and they want to pretend that they're giving equal time to equally deserving positions, when of course they're not. There's no controversy about evolution at all, but they want to pretend there is. And then, of course, controversy is not a good reason to teach something.
Well, explain that. I mean, because most people, when people are listening, they might say, well, wait a minute. Doesn't controversy really play into actually helping to develop critical thinking?
Yes, but they are being selective in the application of critical thinking. you know, for instance, I could say, okay, all Republicans are evil reptilian aliens who are here to destroy the human species.
Oh, that's not controversial. Come on.
Well, some people might say it's controversial. But does the fact that it's controversial mean that we should teach it in the classroom? I don't think so. And it's the same here. The whole idea of evolution is well established. It's a scientific consensus. You can find a few marginal kooks who protest against it, but that does not justify going to the classroom and trying to teach some unfounded, unscientific alternative with no evidence at all for it. So that's why we're opposed to this.
Well, there's something else that, I mean, when you think about this, because there's actually been Supreme Court rulings against the right of people of these people to come in and teach creationism in a science class. But now this is presented as something, it seems like, you know, these people constantly, you know, the Christian fundamentalists, the anti-evolutionists, they keep constantly coming back to sort of hit at it from yet another angle. And including the fact that, wow, you know, look at who's behind this law, Focus on the Family, a Christian fascist group,
Yeah. The
Discovery Institute, really intense that this kind of stuff is coming back and how they're actually cloaking it in, again, this point about academic freedom and we're giving people the right to think critically, you know. And I think your point about controversy is not, you know, you don't teach things just because it's controversial. You know, the controversy there, if you wanted to say there was a controversy in relation to the subjects that they're talking about, there's a controversy that's based on, you know, it's a religious controversy and a political controversy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but like you said, they're trying to couch it in language that makes it sound so sciencey. You know, so for instance, what they say is that the reason they're doing this is to encourage students to explore scientific questions, learn about scientific evidence, develop critical thinking skills. These are all things I am entirely in favor of. But if you are learning those skills, you will learn very quickly that, for instance, creationism is bogus. There's no reason to believe in it. So, you know, they're trying to slip it under the door, cloaked in this friendly language when it's actually anti-scientific at its core.
Now, this is – it's one thing, you know, Tennessee and everybody – and even the fact that they're calling it the monkey law, which harkens back to the Scopes monkey trial and the rest of this. You know, and I can't believe it. Are the Tennessee people in Tennessee actually calling it the monkey law?
I don't know. I haven't heard what they're calling it there. All I know, though, is that it passed by like a 3-1 margin, both the House and Senate in Tennessee. So it's overwhelmingly favored by their legislature, which is simply bizarre for such a useless bill.
And I understand that the Tennessee legislature does open up, in fact, with a rendition of "I'm no kin to a monkey's no kin to me." You know, how can you beat this, man? Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with P.Z. Myers, professor of biology at the University of Minnesota Morris and the author of Pharyngula, the largest, most popular science blog in the world. So, P.Z., let's talk about this. You know, Tennessee is not the first place in the country to have a law like this. And this is something that should put a lot of concern up in a lot of people's heads, because there was a law before this in Louisiana, which has taken pretty strong hold there. And now there's 10 other states lining up behind Tennessee. The repercussions of all this can be pretty serious.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a big worry, because what this does is it gives creationists a loophole, lets them sneak into the classroom, and basically subvert science. And most of all, subvert science education. You know, kids are not just the future scientists of the world. They're the future science teachers of the world. And if you've indoctrinated them in this nonsense, they're going to be less effective in the future. They are basically doing a good job of destroying public education, which is their goal all along.
And in fact, if realistically, destroying any sense of critical thinking, which actually does depend, as you said, I think, again, this thing about not controversy, but what's true. We don't need balance. We don't need just controversy. We need to understand what's actually true and real.
Yes, and we also need to understand why it's true, what the evidence is. That's the important thing with science teaching, is that it's evidence-based, and you explain to the students how we know what we know. And you can't, you know, in the case of creationism, you can't simply say, well, it's because the Bible says so. That's not very informative.
Mm-hmm. And then they come back at you with, well, you can't talk about, look, man, you can't just teach consensus science. Shouldn't that consensus science? I've seen this phrase, and this is the first time I've seen this, is consensus science. You know, they say, well, you know, shouldn't you question consensus science as well as unpopular science?
Sure, but you have to be qualified to do that. I mean, there's lots of things at the edges of science where we're uncertain, where we don't know, and we're constantly testing. But you're not going to do that in a public high school classroom. That's what scientists are doing. That's what our job is to explore those margins and try and settle what the actual truth is out there. And once it's settled, then we can talk about bringing it into the classroom.
Very important point, PZ. Very important point.
Yeah, that's the way it works. Education is not supposed to be right away. We throw you at the cutting edge of science, and now you, the student who doesn't know calculus, who doesn't speak a foreign language, who has no training in biology, will settle these in burning issues in molecular biology and chemistry. Right.
Yeah, there you go. But you know what? Now, give me a break, man, because we do know what? I'm no kin to a monkey, and a monkey's no kin to me. Okay, there you go. We got it set,
that's
man. That's
say.
Yeah. All right, PZ.
I'm a proud relative of many monkeys. Come on.
Yeah, I'm a little bit closer to those monkeys than you are. Okay. Okay. So let's PZ. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again soon when you're not out in some. I don't. Did you say you're like in some Northland and from Game of the Thrones or something?
I'm a kind of.
I think you just got eaten by a bear or an incompetent scientist. I don't know.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, so next time I'll be in a place where we'll talk more clearly.
Okay, PZ. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you again soon. Take care. Bye now. All right. That was PZ Myers. He's a professor of biology at the University of Minnesota Morris, and he's the author of Pharyngula. That's the largest science blog in the entire world. And I don't think he is. It's not based on not being kin to a monkey. OK, so that's never going to get that out of my head. I got to say it often enough that it'll finally wash out of my brain. But I don't think that's going to happen. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Danai Gurira about her play, The Convert. And it's a really powerful play. So stay tuned. Welcome back, Usatembe Nenyoka, and that's from Thomas Mapfumo and the Blacks Unlimited, and it's from the album Chimarenga 98. He's a Zimbabwean musician, and he's known and loved all over the world. I once saw Thomas Mapfumo in the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Harare, and it cost me for 10 hours of music by one band, and the experience of standing nose to nose with just a jam-packed, you know, ballroom. It was an incredible experience. It was 10 hours of music, and it cost, I think $2. And it was like an amazing, amazing night, something I'll never forget. And I played that because what that song title is Don't Play Around with a Snake. All right? And I saw a play last night that I thought this was very appropriate for. This song was very appropriate for. The play is The Convert, and it's by playwright Danai Gurira. And Danai, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Did you ever go to the Queen Elizabeth Hotel?
You know, I don't think I did.
Ah.
And I'm curious, what year was that? Because I wonder if it's been renamed, as have many old colonial names.
Yeah, well, this was in 1987, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it might have been changed. They changed a lot of names around 90.
Mm. Well, this is a place that Bob Marley's best friend had a club, and it was down in that same part of town. And it was a really interesting part of town because it was one of the most exciting and most invigorating culturally. And it was also one of the places where, you know, there was a tremendous, you know, clampdown on a lot of the youth that were there. There were always all these signs around, don't, you know, beware of tzotzis. You know, it's like,
right.
Okay, so.
That's about right.
Yeah. Anyway, your play, What a powerful piece of work. You know, I was blown away by it. I was really blown away by it. And on every level, we'll get into this. The title of the play is The Convert. Give our listeners a sense of the storyline of the play.
Well, the play is based in the 1890s in what is now Zimbabwe, what is now Harare, Zimbabwe. And the 1890s were the moment where the colony of what was then called Rhodesia was really becoming a solid colony, and all the colonial forces were galvanizing. And it centers around a young girl who escapes a forced betrothal through the means of her aunt's employer, who is a very stalwart African catechist, and her journey thereof, getting through the whole and navigation of her identity and the forces around her.
You know, it's really interesting because the play puts you right in the middle of the situation. I mean, I was just, you know, and I was and I'll tell people it's 3 hours long, but you're sitting there and you're like, I didn't want to get up for the intermissions. I was like, no, keep the story going, because you were saying, you once said that theater is the very visceral experience of live storytelling, and that things you can do on stage, there's things you can do on stage that you can't do on live on screen. They don't have the same impact. And, you know, it was remarkable how you staged this thing, and even in terms of conceiving it and writing the dialogue and developing the characters, just a remarkable interplay. Theater has always been to me like, yes, it's the live storytelling, it's sitting around a campfire, it's all this stuff, but there's that three-dimensional interaction that is just, it just blew my mind because, you know, you had, what, five characters?
Seven.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Okay. So, but and it was very interesting because you have this. I think one of the things that you use is you use very well the language and the way that actually so much of the context and the meaning of the play is contained in the way that the language is used. You use Shona. You use English. You use constantly people talking in different languages at each other at the same time, and you really capture a lot of the complexity of the situation that you're trying to portray.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, there's really no other way to portray that world to me. The world I grew up in is a very multilingual world, and, you know, it's a multicultural and cultural clashing type of world, and I wanted to try and make sure that those complexities were alive, and I guess the more you tap into what the world is, the more those things, I think, just have to reveal themselves. It's literally just what I know to be the fabric of life in Zimbabwe.
Well, it's interesting too, because language, not only in terms of how you develop the characters, but the language is actually a big part of the, you know, even what you're portraying about the situation of the African people in Zimbabwe, you know, where the people are not allowed to speak in the vernacular. You know, that's one of the signs of escaping the so-called bestiality or savagery of the indigenous culture, the indigenous, you know, life, and going into the finer points of British colonialism. You know, and the fact that even this thing about the vernacular, I thought that was really interesting because language is playing such a critical role in the way it's thrown about at the stage. But at the same time, it's also playing a critical role in the lives of the people because they're not allowed to even speak their own language.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, that choice. I mean, it was connected to a characterization of Chilford. The idea and an aspect, the sort of the ramifications of colonization, which is the idea that, you know, these people are very different from us. Are we hence deficient? You know, and as a result, the sort of the psyche, the way the psyche gets very messed with, and pathologies start to form in the mind of the colonized. And so that was something in that I was trying to play with. Not even that, it wasn't necessarily often entirely explicit that you never speak your mother tongue, but what it was very implicit that, you know, in order for you to communicate on this level, in order for you to be rewarded by this new system, which is the system of power and control, you need to speak how we speak. And I think that's something that still is a ramification of that right through to present day. And one of the reasons I wanted to deal with this world and start to actually go through the 20th century, going into the 21st century in terms of the Zimbabwean identity through a series of a few plays was because of that sort of, I still see that in the Zimbabwean psyche today, in the post-colonial psyche. We're still navigating and processing the effects of having been colonized, of having received a culture unwillingly that lorded over one and tells one that what we have is better than what you have. And sort of the navigation of really getting to the point where you actually start to realize that's untrue is actually a far trickier one than one would imagine. I think a lot of that can manifest in how the language of power ceases to be your mother tongue.
And that is
something that I was playing with through the characters. Not that it was explicitly imposed by the colonizer, but it was something that you are somewhat excluded from participating in their realm of power if you don't have their linguistic tendencies.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with playwright Danai Gurira about her play, The Convert. And The Convert is now playing over at the Kirk Douglas Theater. Now, Danai, tell me something, because, you know, there's a point here where you tell a very particular story, and I'm really fascinated by what we've just been talking about in terms of the language of power and the rest of this. But it's also, you tell this, you know, in a way, you tell this in a way that you know, you have a power that's there. You have a presence that's there, but it's not there. There's the white power structure in Zimbabwe and in the rest of Africa at that time. This play, the time that it's taking place, had happened just after the Berlin Conference, really, and the division of Africa, where the imperialists were all told that you can have whatever you can hold with force of arms or whatever, you know. And it was this whole carving up of the African continent. And you tell the story with that presence, that power presence, always hovering overhead and weighing down. It's always unseen, but it's very powerful. But the story is a particularly African story and in a way resonates universally, but it's an African story that's told from this perspective, which is really, really interesting to me, because even this Chilford that you were talking about, you know, who actually is the epitome of the guy who's like sort of really bought into, you know, the possibility of bettering oneself through associating with the religion, but also with the force behind the religion in terms of, you know, the British colonialists. And to me, what made you, you know, it must have been difficult to do, because you have all your characters are black, but yet still all the time what's hovering overhead and weighing down is the power structure.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, the, you know, Steve Biko once said, you know, the greatest weapon of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. So, you know, it's really about how do the oppressed respond to the oppressor? How are their minds formulated around this issue or this new presence, you know? And that's what to me was more fascinating to deal with, was really to look at how we as African people responded to these forces and how different people represent in the play as such were representations in a sense of those different responses and of the very complex fabric of life that still exists in post-colonial Africa. That I feel was, you know, the storm really started at this moment in Zimbabwe, at least. And so, yeah, it was very important to me. I generally, I don't know what the next one will do, but definitely in the last couple plays, the last few plays I've written, the antagonist is never on stage. It's far more interesting to me to sort of play with those who are not. Those who are not necessarily the antagonist. It's more complex. I think it's more uncomfortable. You're aware of the complexities of the people who you're not necessarily fully against, and the ramifications therein. So yeah, I don't necessarily do it purposefully, but I did know. I did actually try. I played around with putting Father Helm, for instance, on stage, and it just did not compute. It could not. It just wouldn't work. And that was just me going with what was coming through me, and it was not going to work to put Father Helm on the stage.
You know, it's interesting.
And I enjoy that. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the idea also for me being bicultural as I am and very much being an American and very much being a Zimbabwean. I really love to bring, you know, African faces and voices to whatever stage I'm able to occupy, so that people can really connect to people that generally I don't think they get to connect to. Mm-hmm. The minute you put a Westerner perhaps on the stage, the dynamic shifts that I'm not interested in seeing mm-hmm. happen.
Well, it also strengthens this idea that people are subject to bigger forces that they can't see or know, you know, very tangibly, but it's always there, and it's actually shaping a lot of what goes on, and then people are acting within that, and it's very I found it really compelling to do it the way you did it, which also brings me to this question. You have written a lot about from the perspective of women, And you tell this from a perspective, and that's one that you've mentioned that is not really – it's an infrequent perspective in the theater or anywhere else for that matter. But you feel to compel these stories. And you made a point, which I thought this was really interesting. You said, being a woman with the liability of a vagina, who do you become when the world is against you? I thought that was a very important point that I'd like to explore with that, because that's actually at the heart of a lot of what's in this play.
Yeah. I actually got that. I was having a conversation. My last play, Eclipse, is about women in Liberia during the war there, which ended in 2003. And when I went there to research, I had that conversation with a woman who had navigated the war zone and now worked in human rights issues. And we, you know, we were just discussing. We just really got into the idea that we really just sat in that fact, you know, that having a vagina is such a liability, especially when things go, you know, topsy-turvy in the world. And that's really where that statement came from. But I guess that's always where it's where my passion is. It's where I feel my calling is to give voice to women and to African women specifically. I think they are, you know, complex, rich, powerful, interesting, deeply flawed, amazing people. And I think that it's so rare that we get to hear and see them. So in the realm that I get to give them voice, I definitely will always do so. And it's just not something I'm not going to force upon myself. It's something it's just where, you know, I tend to desire to write from. And so, yeah, this world in this play is absolutely about that. You know, that the fact is, historically, and I always, you know, I like to pick around the actual historical facts of something and then really allow them to feed my imagination. And basically, historically, the trend that you see in Act 1, Scene 1, the event, is actually an event that was happening quite consistently during that time period and going into the 20th century. And it actually happened to a great aunt of mine on my mother's side, which I didn't know about till I'd already started writing this. But the fact that, you know, because the economic system shifted so drastically once, you know, the onslaught of colonization was in full, you know, effect, there was, because of that shift, there was this desire now for, you know, you have to have this white man's money. You have to be able to produce it. You have to exchange world life in it. You can't function without it. And that actually put pressure on certain traditional practices, like that of what is crudely termed the bride price, which actually traditionally is called rora or mbola by the Ndebele, which is really about a gift that the groom's family gives to the bride's family because they are taking the wife, and she becomes a part of their family, you know, in the paternal system of things. And it started to become a much more commercialized exchange because of the pressures of the colonial economy. And so what was happening was girls were then being forced into situations and betrothals that they were very against. And what was happening was they were fleeing to the church. And in the church, under, you know, the Judeo-Christian precepts, you can't do that. And so because the church was now colonially backed, in a sense, it shielded a lot of women from that practice. And that's what you're seeing at the top of the play is Esther's experience therein. And so the idea of, you know, the voice of those who have that liable, very liable part of their bodies constantly being a liability to them, that's really what it's really the Jekify story is that experience. Because she is female, she's in the situation she's in at the top of the play. And how does she find empowerment? That where she does find it, and this is where the complexity of it all comes through, because where she does find it is through the Catholic faith. Ironically, many will say. And that's the complexity of how Christianity interacts with the African.
You know, it's interesting, too. I mean, one of the things that you bring out, too, is that the constant presence of this liability, including, in fact, towards the end of the play, and we won't do any spoilers, but the point that where someone is in the most dire circumstances of their life, this young man, and he's really at the point of no hope, no anything, no possibility, and yet he still asserts male privilege. And it was like so insane.
Yes. Yes.
And he gets called out on it by one of my favorite characters in the play. Prudence was actually, you know, remarkable.
Yes. Yeah. And it is interesting. I mean, that's the complexity that, you know, I try to explore, because it's just, you know, to me, it's just real, you know, that there's a mindset that, you know, is very paternal in traditional African culture. And traditional culture is pretty much most of the world, really.
Actually, yeah, in any class society, that's what's going on. Women, you know, they tell men, you might have it bad, but you know what? At least you rule over your woman, you know. That's a very sick thing. Denai, we're going to have to wrap it up because we're running out of time, unfortunately. But really, the play is remarkable. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. All right. And we'll have you back with your next play, too. Let's stay in touch. All right. Take care now.
Absolutely.
All right. You too.
Sure.
Okay. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. And we've just been talking with playwright Denai Guerrera about her new play, The Convert. That brings this edition of the show pretty close to an end. But before we go, you know, thinking about today's show, we've really been talking about something that impacts the whole world. The show has been about the world, whether it's Zimbabwe and the relationships between men and women, the oppression of women, patriarchy, colonization, the relationship between the colonized and the colonizer, or the whole question of genocide and the terrible, terrible relations that are imposed on people throughout the world. And oftentimes when you look behind it, it doesn't take much looking to find the hand of imperialism. Well, I wanted to do something along a theme, and that theme is, captured in a comment from Bob Avakian. And that comment is taken from Avakian's book, Basics. Internationalism, the whole world comes first. Now, here's a quote, though, that I wanted to read that's sort of in that spirit. Now, let's imagine. Let's step out of this world that they keep us chained in, and let's imagine what this future can and will be like. When we finally get to the goal of communism, there won't be the relations of exploitation and oppression that are so commonplace and that mark all of society today and that we are told over and over again are just the natural order of things and the way things have to be. As Karl Marx pointed out, the communist revolution leads to what we Maoists call the four alls, that is, the abolition of all class differences among people. The abolition or the end to all the production or economic relations underlying these class differences and divisions among people. The ending of all the social relations that go along with these economic or production relations. Oppressive relations between men and women, between different nationalities, between people of different parts of the world. All that will be put an end to and moved beyond. And finally, the revolutionizing of all the ideas that go along with this whole way, this whole capitalist system. These whole social relations. In place of this, what will be the guiding principles in society consciously and voluntarily taken up by people? Not forced on them, but consciously and voluntarily taken up as the basis for having abolished exploitation, oppression, and inequality. In its place will be collective and cooperative principles aiming for the common good, and at the same time, within that, individuals and individuality flourishing in a way that has never been possible before. Once again, that was taken from Bob Avakian's book, Basics. All right, having said that, I want to say one more thing. We all know that the world today, as it exists today, is a horror. That's true. But something that's even more profoundly true is something that we also don't get a whole lot of times, and that is that it doesn't have to be this way. The world is not this the way it is. It's not a horror because of human nature or anything else. It's all because of this system, this capitalist imperialist system. And once we get rid of that, we can move on to a whole new world. So think about that. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a piece from a new album by Dr. John. That album is Locked Down, and the piece is Revolution. Very appropriate for today, and a really killer song.